This past week, I had breakfast with a couple of pastors, and we were talking about church, not surprising, and about how the things that we're trying to do in our churches go against the grain of our culture. And there are many ways that Christianity, particularly in this moment of time in America, is countercultural. And just think about this. Here we are on a Sunday morning. Most people are not in houses of worship at this time. Or let me rephrase that. I guess some people are in houses of worship, whether it's their own house, a coffee house, or the house that Brady and Belichick built. Most people are not in Christian houses of worship on Sunday mornings. Another way that we are countercultural is we live in a culture where we're surrounded by screens. And yet you notice that there are no screens here in the building. We could have them, we could spend the money, but it's intentional. We don't need to have them. We want to get away from those distractions when we're here. We live in a culture where people don't really think, react, but they don't really think. And yet Christians are taught to love the Lord our God with all our minds, somewhere that gets erased from a lot of people's Bibles. We are to think deeply. We also live in a culture where we read a lot of things that are really not important, texts and junk on the internet. We don't stop and read books. And yet, Christians are to be a people of the book, the Bible. We spend a lot of time here talking about this written text that is before us and thinking about it. We live in an age, and this is related, in which the attention span is very short. And attention has become the most important currency. Getting people's attention, getting their eyeballs on your screen, getting their likes, smash that subscribe button. You know, all this stuff, right? People trying to do anything just to get the attention of others. And here we are trying to get away from distractions and focus on these long sermons. Crazy. We live in a very consumeristic and individualistic society in which everything is commodified. We think of our needs, our wants, our desires. What are we getting out of it? What am I getting out of this? And sadly, that infects the church. And so people just approach church as some kind of religious product to consume. What church gives me what I want? Well, I'll go here. I didn't like that church. I'm going to go to this church. I like that more. Maybe there's another church I like more than that, so I'll keep shopping. Now let us think about how Christianity really goes against the grain of culture. Naturally, we are self-interested, self-centered. We think about the self. We love the self. Yet Christianity calls us to look not only to our own interests, but also the interests of others. And more to the point, we're supposed to be a humble people who view others as being more significant than ourselves. I've heard it said that we are supposed to, this is the way God made us, to love people and use things. But in our mess, we love things and use people. And Christianity really goes against the grain in this way. We were made for God, all human beings. We were made to know God, know who He is, know Him personally, to love Him, to trust Him, to worship Him, to obey Him, praise and honor Him, to do life on His terms. That's why we exist. And then we just turn it all around and we think that, no, God exists for us. How, God, can you live on my terms? Or how can you serve me on my terms? We don't think about how we can fit into God's agenda. Instead, we think about how we can fit God into ours. Now, sometimes I think all of this is new and all of this is worse than it's ever been. I do think that the habits and practices of our day make a lot of this worse. Not just the beliefs that are out there. They're obviously wrong beliefs, but just the habits, the practices. Technology, it's not really neutral because it forms things within us. It forms a certain way of being. And I think just the fact that you can call up all this stuff on your phone, it almost makes you think like you're the captain of everything. It's up to me. I can swipe this way, that way. I can click this thing. Someone will come to me with a product. It's amazing. But it makes us think maybe we're the center of reality. But the fact is, all of these things that we fight against, whether they're self-centeredness, consumeristic way of being, focusing on things that don't really matter, all that stuff has been with us for a long time. Fundamentally, there's nothing new about human nature. From the beginning, people have wanted God to live life on their terms and not the other way around. From the beginning, people have made gods in their image instead of realizing and thinking about it, what it means that they're made in God's image. From the beginning, people have tried to use God for their purposes instead of thinking about how they can live for God's purposes. We see some of that in this passage that we'll look at today. We're looking at Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 21, as we continue our study of this book of the Bible. So I invite you to turn there. If you don't have a Bible, there's one right in front of you, maybe one under the chair if you're sitting in the back or on the chair next to you. And this is on page 838 of the Bibles that we have here. Now, if you haven't been with us recently in Sunday mornings, we've been going through this Gospel of Mark, one of four biographies of Jesus that we find in the Bible. The Gospel, literally, that word just means good news, because Jesus is good news. He's the greatest news. And each Gospel gives us a little bit of different information, gives us a different angle on Jesus. And it's important to study these Gospels because Jesus is the most important person who's ever walked the face of this planet. One of the things that we do as a church is we try to go through whole books of the Bible and not just kind of like go through the highlights. Sometimes it's easy. You know, there's certain passages that are just like, that's awesome. And, you know, you get a lot of power out of that. And it's just easy to gravitate to those passages. Sometimes we have to dig a little bit. And I think this morning I'm kind of like digging a little bit. Why does Mark give us this stuff here? That's what I'm trying to do. Well, this morning I'm going to be grabbing these three paragraphs that may not seem to go together at first glance, but I think they do go together, and I think they show us some surprising things, ways that people respond to Jesus, ways that people relate to Jesus, and all that is very relevant as we should be thinking about how we relate to Jesus, how we respond to Jesus. So I'm just going to begin reading through this. I'll take it paragraph by paragraph and explain what's going on. Begin with verses 7 through 12. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and from around Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God!" And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. What have we seen so far in Mark's Gospel? Skipping past a little bit of the John the Baptist portion, we've seen that Jesus has gone out into the world and he's done a few things. He's been preaching this message about God's kingdom. He has called a handful of people to himself. We've encountered five disciples thus far, they're mentioned by name. He has done miracles. He has healed people in miraculous ways. And we see that he is drawing crowds. But he's also gathering some enemies too. We saw last week in verse 6, the verse right before I began reading, that there are some Jewish leaders, the Pharisees, who were meeting up with these other Jews, the Herodians, people who have been in support of King Herod. So you get like the religious and the political, and they're taking counsel together, figuring out how they can destroy Jesus.
So Jesus already has some opposition too.
Now, in the paragraph that I just read, Jesus is not surrounded by those enemies. Though he withdrew to the Sea of Galilee, we're told that a great crowd followed him. And we're told that these people came from all around, which is a really interesting thing. He has only been doing ministry in this region of Galilee, which is basically on the western part of the Sea of Galilee. So that's the place where Capernaum and Nazareth are. So he's only been doing works there, and yet not only do people come from Galilee, they come from the south, from Judea, this region where Jerusalem and Bethlehem are, which makes sense. And Jerusalem is picked out because that's the most important city politically and certainly religiously. But then people are also coming even further south from this place called Idumea. People are coming from the east of the Jordan River, beyond the Jordan. And they're coming from like the north by northwest to these cities that are on the Mediterranean coast, Tyre and Sidon. And it seems like Mark wants us to know that Jesus is drawing crowds. The word is getting out about Jesus, that he is doing things that can hardly be believed. And he is teaching with authority, though it seems that at this point people are coming in because of the healing, because of the miracles. Now, this could be some kind of indication that maybe different parts of Israel are joining together around Jesus. In the Old Testament, God called one man named Abraham to himself. God told Abraham that he would be a father of many, that his offspring would bless the world. And in time, that one man and his family became a large group of people. They became a nation. We know them as Israel. And God brings them into this land that has been known as Canaan or Israel or Palestine. And these people were united. At one point, they were united under kings like David and his son Solomon. But after Solomon's reign, after Solomon dies, the kingdom gets split into two. And then over centuries, different parts of the kingdom are conquered by foreign powers. And by the time of Jesus, it's all kind of splintered. Here you got people coming from different parts of what was Israel. Maybe there's this hope, you know, everyone's going to get together again. But then when we look at the regions that are listed, we also see some interesting things. There were some places that, yes, were part of Israel, like Galilee and Judea. But then there were also people that weren't Jewish. The Idumeans were related to Edom, the descendants of Esau. They're considered kind of like mixed race of people, Jewish mixed with Gentiles. And then you've got these two cities, Tyre and Sidon, that are known as being Gentile cities. Well, maybe this is the indication that both Jews and Gentiles are coming to Jesus. After all, you see passages in the Old Testament prophets saying that Israel's going to be regathered, but not only that, the nations are going to stream in. Maybe this is a sign of that. However, here's the interesting thing. Jesus does not seem to be thrilled about the crowd. He's not like, yes, you guys are here. How can I welcome you? I was waiting for you. Thank you for finally showing up. What can I do for you? We see first he has this concern about the crowds getting unruly. I'm not sure how many people were there. I'm sure there were hundreds. Maybe there were more than, you know, maybe there were thousands. And you know, when a bunch of people get together and there's not a lot of structure, the crowd can get very unruly. There can be like crowd surges and rushes, and there are times in history where people have been killed because they got trampled by crowds, whether it's at concerts or sporting events or stuff like that. It's happened so much, there's a Wikipedia page dedicated to it. A list of fatal crowd rushes. First one is from AD 80 in Israel, interestingly enough. So Jesus is near the Sea of Galilee, and he says, all right, my guys, he's got four fishermen he's called so far, get me in the boat and put me on the boat because I don't want to get trampled by all these crowds. And we do see in the next chapter, in chapter 4, Jesus preaches from a boat, kind of like a floating pulpit, but here it's just a safety issue. Now, Jesus had healed many people up to this point. And there were more people who were trying to get healed. We're told that people with diseases were pressing up against him, hoping that they could just get touched. If I could just touch the hem of his garment,
and I'd be made well.
And we might call this kind of a magical belief in Jesus' power. They realize Jesus is not just a normal person, that somehow there's this divine power that is at least flowing through him. And it's like, well, maybe they'd get a little bit of that power, it would make me well. But interestingly, we're not told that Jesus actually heals people at this moment. Now, he had healed people. He had done things that hadn't been done in Israel for hundreds of years, the kind of signs and wonders, these miracles that Jesus is performing. Those are the kind of things that the prophets Elijah and Elisha did. Very unusual. And then you go hundreds of years without seeing quite that kind of stuff. And now there's this man who's doing it. Of course people are going to come. People who are desperate. People who wanted to be healed. But we're not told that they had a true faith in Jesus. We're not told that they had a hunger for his message. It seems that they just wanted to be healed. But not only do we have this crowd, some of whom had physical issues, they wanted to get healed. We're also told that there are some unclean spirits, some demons. So there are people who are demon afflicted among the masses. Now, as I said the last time I preached in the Gospels, we do see a lot of demonic activity, which is unusual. You go through the Old Testament, it's not so much. I mean, there's this person named Satan, but it's not like there's all kinds of demonic activity. But it makes sense. Think about this. The Son of God comes to earth. Satan and his demons don't like that. And they meet the Son of God with more opposition. And so when Jesus is on earth, there's more satanic, demonic activity. The Bible indicates these things are real. And Jesus was opposed by these forces. Yet they're no match for Jesus. When the unclean spirits see it's the Son of God, they don't try to fight. They don't push back. They just fall to the ground and they declare, truly, you're the Son of God. Here's something that's really odd, though. Jesus didn't say, you're darn right I am. Go and tell people. Don't say that to anyone. Don't let word get out that I'm the Son of God. That's really kind of odd when you think about it. There are a lot of odd things that are going on here. This large crowd of people coming to Jesus, you'd think that's a good thing. But notice that they don't recognize that Jesus is the Son of God. And notice that Jesus doesn't warmly embrace them. He doesn't heal them. It might have driven out the demons, or the demons are just driven out because Jesus' presence was there. But he doesn't seem to attract the crowd in a way. He doesn't want to keep the crowd. He's not trying to hold on to the crowd. He's not pleading with the crowd to stay with him. It's at least an ambivalence on Jesus' part toward the crowd. So this is odd. What's going on here? Well, let's address these two issues in order. First, this idea about Jesus not necessarily being thrilled about the crowd. Now, the reason why that is the case, and Mark doesn't say this explicitly, but I think the reason why that's the case is because Jesus knows the motivations of these people. And I see this, we've got to turn to another gospel. You can turn to the Gospel of John, so two books of the Bible forward. And at the beginning of John's gospel, and the end of chapter 2, this is after Jesus has done his first sign, his first public miracle, which is turning water into wine at a wedding. We're told about why people were coming to Jesus and what Jesus did in response to that. So John 2, verses 23 through 25. Now when he was in Jerusalem, Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man.
So John tells us Jesus is performing miracles, and that's just bound to attract people. Some people were probably just fascinated. Like, it's just, you know, people want to see a spectacle. What's this? What is he doing? He did what? I got to see that for myself. Other people, you know, again, sick, injured, hoping for some healing. Not surprising. What is surprising, though, is that Jesus did not entrust himself to them. Now, John says they believed in his name, but I think he's probably using that in a somewhat ironic way. Not in a full fleshed out kind of, I trust in Jesus, and therefore I'm forgiven of my sins and I'm in the right with God, which we believe. But they're believing in maybe his power, his ability to heal. That's undeniable. But Jesus is not giving himself over to them. He's not trusting them because he knows what's inside of us. He knows that people can come to him for the wrong reasons. It's a really important idea. Don't be naive about this. People can be interested in Jesus for the wrong reasons. Sometimes we're so excited when someone shows an interest in Jesus. Oh, that's great. They say they believe in Jesus. Yay! 32 people were saved today. We don't know. Maybe they're coming for the wrong reasons. That's a real possibility. People were coming to Jesus because they wanted stuff from him, but they didn't want him. That is our problem in a nutshell. We don't desire God truly for himself. We want the stuff that God can give us. We want the blessings, not the blesser. We want the gifts, not the giver. We want created things, not the creator. Let's be clear. Jesus is the Son of God. Mark begins his gospel with that claim. First verse. That doesn't mean all the people that Jesus is encountering realize that. These crowds did not understand that. Strangely, the demons do. But to say that Jesus is the Son of God does not mean that he was created or that he's some kind of like lesser deity. You know, there's the Father and there's the Son. We're Trinitarians. We believe there is one God, and yet in ways that are mysterious and hard to understand, there are three persons in this Godhead. One God in three persons, Father, Son, and the Spirit. So Jesus, as the Son of God, is eternal, knows no beginning. He is all-powerful, all-knowing, perfectly holy, always been around. Everything that God is doing, Jesus is a part of in some way. Everything that God wills is Jesus' will as the Son of God. And yet, over 2,000 years ago, the Son of God then takes on also this human nature, conceived and born of a virgin, grows up, has a body like ours, has bodily needs like ours, could die. But the point that I want to make now is Jesus is God, just as much as the Father and the Spirit are God. And our problem is, though God made us for himself, we exist for God's sake. We believe that God should do things for us and that he should be at our beck and call. We like the benefits of God. We like living in his world. We enjoy the beauty and the goodness of many aspects of creation. We like it when he blesses us with good things, whether it's health, family and friends, a job, finances. But we don't desire God for his own sake. And that is borne out. It's evidenced in the way that we spend our time, the things that we dream about, daydream about, things that we want most, the amount of time that we spend in prayer, Bible reading, the extent to which we do or do not obey God's commands. All of those things reveal where our hearts really are. And so these people, they come to Jesus, but he knows their hearts, and he does not entrust himself to them because they have not entrusted themselves to Jesus. We need to know this. Jesus will not be manipulated or used. He's not some genie in a bottle who must grant our wishes. God is not some cosmic ATM, and you just punch in the right code in Jesus' name, and he gives you what you want. He doesn't dance when we say dance.
Jesus is Lord. He is King. He is the Master, the Boss. He's not some talisman, good luck charm. He's not some circus act. He doesn't perform when we want him to perform. And he knows our motivations. He won't be fooled by us if we look really impressive and we use all the right religious language, but our hearts are really just trying to use him. So that explains why Jesus isn't so thrilled about crowds necessarily. But what about him silencing these unclean spirits? I mean, they're unclean spirits, demons, bad. But they're saying the truth. You are the Son of God. Why doesn't Jesus like say, yeah, say it louder? Shut up, don't tell anyone. This is the third time that he's tried to keep people from getting his identity out. And the second time, in Mark's gospel anyway, that he's told demons, zip it. So what's going on here? Well, sometimes this is called the messianic secret. Jesus is trying to keep his identity as the Messiah or Christ. That means like the anointed one, the anointed king of Israel, promised king who would come, a secret. And here he's trying to keep his identity as the Son of God a secret. Why would he do that? Well, maybe to help us understand, I want to talk about a documentary I saw recently. It's about a guy named Clark Kent. It's pretty amazing. I think it's true. I saw it. Never mind. All right. I mentioned Superman a couple months ago. I'm going to mention it again because it's right there in this movie. So in the last sort of iteration of Superman, not the most recent one, but the one before, where Superman's played by the British actor Henry Cavill, there's this movie, Man of Steel, which shows the familiar Superman story, you know, where his biological parents are on this planet called Krypton, and the planet is just about to blow up, and so they send their precious one-of-a-kind, only-begotten son away to Earth, right? And we know that story. If you've seen even the first one with Christopher Reeve, it's a very similar story in terms of that background. We find out Superman's real name is Kal-El, which is similar to a Hebrew phrase for the voice of God. In fact, in the movie, he's called the son of El, and El is a Hebrew word for God. So it's almost like saying he's God's son. Superman says he's 33, which is the age that people think Jesus he died and rose at. At one point in the movie, Jesus' birth father is sort of appearing in this like digital form. It's kind of hard to explain, but Jesus' birth father, Jor-El, tells him, sorry, Superman, this like gets confusing. Superman's father says to Superman, you can be the bridge between two peoples, the Kryptonians and the people on Earth. And he says, you can save Lois Lane. You can save all of them, like all humanity. And right after he says this, Superman goes like this. And then he turns and he flies away. It's not an accident. The people who are making this movie, they know what they're doing. There's this Christ all written all over that movie. Well, in that same movie, if you know the story of Superman, he comes to Earth and he's raised in Kansas by these farmers. And his dad, Jonathan Kent, tells him, don't show your powers when he's a boy, when he's a teenager. Because even then, he has super strength and everything. He's like, don't do that. Don't show your powers. Even to like the bullies, you want to beat them up. You want to do good things. Don't do that. And little Clark Kent's like, why not? He says, because when the world finds out what you can do, they're going to be afraid. And they're going to hate you. Or they're going to try to kill you. Even that's what Superman's birth mother was worried about. They're going to view him as a freak. They're going to try to kill him. And Superman's birth father says, how are they going to do that? He'll be like a god to them. So, Superman not revealing his identity until the time was right. Well, something is happening with Jesus. Imagine if Jesus just comes on the scene at age 30. He says, okay, now the time is right. I am the Messiah, the Christ. Well, people would probably misunderstand what kind of anointed king he was. They think, oh, you're going to get rid of the Romans. Yes, get rid of them. Awesome. Give us back our freedom. Give us back our land. People might have written him off as crazy, though, because around this time, there were a lot of people who were claiming to be Messiah. It's kind of a weird moment in history.
Now, if he said, I am the Son of God, people might even misunderstand that, because in the ancient world, kings were viewed as sons of God. I mean, even the Roman emperor, Caesar Augustus, who was the emperor when Jesus was born, he was supposed to be the Son of God. It's not really, of course. But maybe people would just think Jesus is crazy. And so they would either kind of shun him, ostracize him, get out of here, or they would kill him. What if he just says, I am God? The Jewish mind had no way to comprehend Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, being human in form. Like, that just didn't calculate for them. And so again, they would probably think he's crazy, or if he persisted, they would just kill him. You're blaspheming. Now, Jesus did come to die. He knew he was going to die. He came not only to seek and to save the lost, he came to save his people from their sins. How does he do it? He gives his life as a ransom for many. He comes to bear the penalty of sin that we deserve to pay. He is treated as the worst of criminals, dies in this horrific way, not just this painful physical death, but the penalty of sin deserves a true spiritual death, a condemnation, God's wrath poured out against our rebellion. Jesus never rebelled against God, never sinned, but he comes to be the sin bearer of all who would put their faith in him. Real faith, trust. A trust marked by love and a willingness to obey. But Jesus didn't come to die right then. No, he doesn't want people to misunderstand who he is, misunderstand the claims that he's the Christ, that he is the Son of God, that he's divine. And he doesn't want people to kill him right then, because he's got more things to do. And I think, in fact, what he's doing throughout, by slowly he's healing people, he's showing his power over nature, he claims to forgive sins, he even can bring the dead back to life. In all these ways, he is slowly and inductively leading people who have eyes to see that he is indeed God as well as man, that he is the Son of God in the way that we understand him to be. It was not time for his identity to be leaked, so he commands these demons, be quiet. We see all of this. Jesus is in control. He's not needy. I need you, crowds. Please bring more. Bring your friends. He's not challenged. He's not afraid of the demons. They can't do anything to him. He's telling them what to do. And now we see that he will choose an inner circle of followers. He isn't at the go after the crowds. Instead, he selects 12 men. So let's read the next paragraph, verses 13 through 19. And he, again Jesus, went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, however you say that, and Simon the Zealot, let's call him Thad for now, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. He's called James by the other gospel writers. I don't know. It's made it harder, Mark. People often have two names in the Bible, so Levi is Matthew. You think Bartholomew is Nathaniel. It's just is what it is. All right, so on a very simple level, this is what Jesus is doing. He's picking 12 men. Notice, Jesus doesn't need people to come to him. He goes and gets the people he wants. He comes to seek. And he takes these men as his official delegates to go out and to preach and to cast out demons in his name. And the 12 men are listed. We've already met 5 of them, 4 fishermen. We've got 2 sets of brothers, Simon and Andrew, James and John. We've got the tax collectors known as Levi earlier, and it's Matthew. Jesus gives Simon a new name,
One that apparently actually wasn't being used before, which is interesting. I thought that Peter would, like a lot of people, there'd be a lot of Peters all over the place. But the word Peter, in Greek it's Petros, it just means rock or stone. And he takes that noun and he makes it a proper name and assigns it to Simon. It's kind of like, imagine if you didn't know Rocky Marciano or Rocky Balboa, you didn't know anything, no Rocky and Bullwinkle, and you just, you know, all you know are rocks. And then Jesus said, I'm going to call you Rocky from now on. Now, we're not told why in Mark, but Matthew says that Jesus claims that he will build his church on the rock that is Peter, probably meaning Peter and the apostles, that they are the foundation of the church, as Paul says in Ephesians 2. I'm not going to get in all the details about exactly who these men are now, but we do see they're called apostles, and that's an important concept. Apostolos in Greek just means someone who is sent, like an envoy, a delegate, a messenger, someone who has been commissioned in some official way and is representing someone else. Go out, send my word out. And they're not just people who are sent in like a broad way, because you could say, well, any Christian is in a way kind of sent, you know, go tell other people about me. But they are witnesses of Jesus' life, and they will be witnesses of Jesus' death and his resurrection. And we get a sense of the way they function as witnesses when Peter later gives a speech in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 10, after a Gentile man named Cornelius comes to faith, Peter says this in Acts 10, beginning in verse 34. He says, truly I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. As for the word that he sent to Israel, preaching good news of peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know what happened throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism that John proclaimed, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. He went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of all that he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all the people, but to us who had been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. To him all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. So the apostles, they were unique witnesses. They saw Jesus. They were with him. Saw him dead. Saw him alive again. And they were commissioned by him to go out and preach. There are no more capital A apostles, because there are no 2,000-year-old people, I think. Jesus calls not only disciples, that's a Greek word that basically means students. You know, Jesus doesn't have fans. He has followers, people who want to learn from him, people who will put his words into practice. But he also calls official witnesses who will preach in his name. So that's basic level what's going on. But think about this more deeply. We're told Jesus goes up to a mountain. We're not told which mountain it was, where it was exactly, but he goes up on a mountain and he calls 12 men. Why a mountain? Why 12? Well, in Israel's history, mountains are very important. Particularly Mount Sinai. That's where God calls Moses. That's where God makes a covenant with Israel, meets with Moses and the elders. That's where later he will speak to Elijah. And when God met with Israel at Mount Sinai, he made a covenant with them. They became a nation ruled by God and God's commandments. And here we see Yahweh is once again meeting with his people. And he chooses 12 intentionally, just as there were 12 tribes of Israel. There are 12 apostles. In a way, Jesus is reforming Israel around himself. He later will tell the apostles that they will judge or rule over the 12 tribes of Israel. And there's a good argument to be made that Jesus really is true Israel. He says of himself in John 15, I'm the true vine. Well, what is the vine? You go to the Old Testament, we find Israel is referred to as a vine. Or you can look at the beginning of Isaiah 49, if you read that carefully, you see that Israel is Jesus in that sense. And we could say that all who are attached to the vine are part of true Israel, the true people of God, people united to Christ, who are in him. The only way to be part of God's people, the only way to be united to God himself, is to have a true abiding faith in Jesus. Now, it seems very nice that Jesus could choose these 12 new heads of Israel, but it's not so neat as that, because there's an ominous note at the end. Oh, notice there's also this guy named Judas Iscariot who would betray Jesus. Jesus knew that this would happen. Jesus is not surprised by any of this. None of this catches him by surprise. Not like, oops, should have done a better pick. All right, we'll get Matthias next time. Jesus chose Judas. He knows the hearts of people. He knows the hearts of the crowd. He knows the heart of Judas. He knows that he came to die. He knew that Judas would play a role in that death. Judas would betray Jesus to the Jewish rulers. I know where you can get him away from the crowds. You can arrest him under the cover of darkness over here. So we see Jesus is in complete command, and he even uses evil to bring about good, to advance his purposes. And Judas probably thought he could use Jesus. We don't know a lot about Judas, but we do know he was basically the treasurer of the disciples. He had their money, and John tells us, and he liked taking from that. He stole from that. He was a thief. And he betrayed Jesus for a pretty paltry amount of money, but still money. So maybe he thought Jesus was the way to get rich. But in the end, it is Jesus who uses Judas, not the other way around. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but let's just finish today's passage. We'll read the next couple of verses 20 and 21. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat. When his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, "He is out of his mind." So again, the crowd finds Jesus at home. This is probably the home of Peter and Andrew, where Jesus was staying. The crowd probably wants to use Jesus again. "Heal us." And Jesus hasn't multiplied food yet, but maybe there's a hope they could get some food from him. Who knows? So they want to use Jesus, but Jesus' family is different. They're seeing Jesus from a different angle. And I'm not going to say much about it this week, because Torah will cover this more next week. But it seems that when they see crowds around Jesus, they're like, "He's out of his mind." I don't know why they assume that. Maybe the only way Jesus could get these crowds would be saying some pretty wild stuff. You know, maybe he's just gone off the rails, and now he's talking nonsense, and people are interested in that. Some people today think that Jesus is like that in a way. They think this is all silly, this is all fable, this is all legend, all superstition. People react to Jesus in these ways today. Again, some people try to use Jesus. We have the peddlers of the prosperity gospel who want to use Jesus to get rich. They want blessings from Jesus like the crowd did. They want healing. They want money. There are people who use Jesus to advance their political agenda. Well, if I just hold the Bible, if I just talk about Jesus. Both sides of the aisle do this too. I'll show up in some random church sometime, say things I don't really believe. Some people are pushing in what I would call an emotional prosperity gospel. I have this vision of human flourishing, and I will use Jesus as my pathway to get to what I think we should be doing. Make us feel good. Make us have a good society, whatever that is. You've got New Age gurus. They like to appeal to Jesus. Here's this wise man. He's the embodiment of some eternal wisdom that you can have too. We're all divine. Ooh. There are many ways that people use Jesus. But what they're trying to do is get something else. A career, money, healing, a good relationship, followers, attention, whatever. And they're using Jesus as a means to get there. Instead of seeing Jesus as the end goal. Instead of seeing Jesus as the good news, Jesus as the treasure, see Jesus as a means to get what they really want. And people like that, doesn't matter exactly what they're doing, what their end game is, they are going to be very surprised on that great day when Jesus judges the living and the dead. We need to love Jesus for who he is and desire him for him. Now, there are other people that are like Jesus' family. They reject Jesus because they think this is all nonsense. Again, it's a fable, it's a fairy tale, it's superstition, it's not real. I don't have time this morning to give us evidence and arguments for the historicity of Jesus in the Gospels. I'd love to do that. I can do that. If you have questions about that or you have doubts, I'd love to sit down with you. Just have an exchange about these things. But for now, I'd say this. As you keep reading about Jesus, and if you think deeply about him, who he is, I'd say this. He's like the key that unlocks all of what we really want, what we really desire if we knew better. If we truly understood our own desires and who Jesus is, we'd see he's the one that fulfills the deep longings of the human heart. He's the one that makes sense out of life. But the main message I want us to hear today is Jesus is the Son of God. We don't get to define who he is. He is King and Lord. He's in complete command. He has complete authority. He will not be used. He will not be manipulated. Jesus is the true Israel, and only those who are united to him by faith will receive God's eternal blessings, including forgiveness of sins and eternal life and a new creation. And at the end of the day, we will either be with Jesus because we are for him, not using him, for him, or we will be against him. We cannot get Jesus on our side. What matters is if we are on his side. And I'll close with this thought. I'm reminded of a story from the Old Testament. So after God makes this covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai, after he leads them through the wilderness for 40 years, he brings them into this land that he promised he would give them. And as they're being led by Joshua, and they're about to have a kind of military conquest of the land, we read this in Joshua, the book of Joshua, chapter 5, verses 13 through 15. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come." Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. You catch that? Joshua, leader of Israel at this time, Moses' successor, leading people, knows he's going to face some enemies. He sees this angel that has an appearance of a man, and he says, "Hey, are you with Israel or are you with the bad guys? Whose side are you on?" No. It's just one of these brilliant points in the Bible. No, you're asking the wrong question. Joshua, you should be asking, which side are you on? The same thing is true of Jesus. We cannot use or manipulate him, win him to our side. How can we get Jesus on my team? We should be concerned about whether we're on his team. We don't say, "Jesus, are you with the Republicans or are you with the Democrats?" No. But I'm the commander of the army of the Lord. I'm the Son of God. Now I have come. Will you be on my side? That's the question for us. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for sending your Son, your precious Son, into the world. We thank you that He knows what is in us. He knows our hearts. He knows how messed up we are. He knows that we can desire him for the wrong reasons.
And he doesn't play that game. In many ways, he made it harder for all the people who were pursuing him for the wrong reasons. And yet, we're thankful that he comes and he draws people to himself. Those whom he desires, he brings to you. We thank you that he did all that he did, not just teaching with a great authority and insight, not just doing these signs and wonders which back up his identity claims and give us a foretaste of what he will do in the end and making everything right in the world. We're also thankful that he came to die. We deserve that kind of death. We deserve to bear your wrath, and Jesus did that in our place. And my prayer this morning is simply that we would treasure Jesus for himself, that we would not seek to use him, manipulate him, that we would not think of some goal beyond Jesus as the greatest, the highest good. I pray that we would see and believe truly that our greatest desire should be you, that the greatest being is you. That the greatest being is the triune God. Help us to love you the way that we should. I think all of us can slip into that mode of seeing you as a means to an end. Please keep us from that. Keep us from these distorted desires. Renew our hearts. Renew our minds. Forgive us for the many ways that we approached you wrongly. I pray, Father, that we would approach you for the right reasons. And I pray that you would bring more people to your Son and that you would transform their hearts and minds so they would come to Jesus rightly too. We pray this in his name.